Okay, so here we are. See how discombobulated I am. What is today, the 5th or something like that? The 6th?
6th.
Okay, December 6th. So, I am recapping the Joseph story. I started at verse 59, and Joseph's brethren came and entered into him. They knew him. He knew them, but they knew him not. And when he had provided them with their provision, he said, "Bring me your brother on your father's side." That would be Benjamin. "Do you not see that I give you full measure of corn and that I am the best of hosts? But if you bring him not to me, then there shall be no measure of corn for you from me, nor shall you come near to me." So this is the beginning of that episode where, because of the famine, Jacob sends some of his sons to Egypt. And he said to his servants, this is Joseph speaking, "Put their money also into their saddlebags, that they may recognize it when they return to their family. Happily they may come back." So, I mean, they had offered money, I guess, for food, and he said, "Well, you're not going to get anything until you bring Benjamin," but then he also gives them their money back. "And when they returned to their father and said, O our father, a further measure of corn has been denied us. So send with us our brother, that we may obtain our measure, and we will surely take care of him." He said, "I cannot trust you with him, save as I trusted you with his brother before," right? He remembers, you know, from long ago when they didn't, you know, they're basically untrustworthy. "But Allah is the best protector, and he is the most merciful of those who show mercy." So, "And when they opened their goods, they found their money returned to them. And they said, 'Oh, our father, what more can we desire? Here is our money. Return to us. We shall bring provision for our family and guard our brother, and we shall have in addition the measure of a camel load. That is a measure which is easy to obtain.' He said, 'I will not,'" that's the father speaking, that's Jacob speaking, "'I will not send him with you until you give me a solemn promise in the name of Allah that you will surely bring him to me unless you are encompassed.' And when they gave him their solemn promise, he said, 'Allah watches over what we say.'" So he didn't want the same thing to happen to Benjamin as he had perceived had happened to Joseph. And he said, "O my sons, enter not by one gate," this is Jacob speaking, "but enter by different gates. And I can avail you nothing against Allah. The decision rests only with Allah. In him do I put my trust, and in him let all who would trust put their trust." And when they entered in the manner their father had commanded them, it could not avail them anything against Allah, except that there was a desire in Jacob's mind, which was which he thus satisfied, and he was surely possessed of great knowledge, because we had taught him, but most men know not. Let's see. "And when they visited Joseph, he lodged his brother with himself, and he said, 'I am thy brother, so now grieve not at what they have been doing.' And when they had provided him with their provision, he put the drinking cup in his brother's saddlebag. Then the crier cried, 'O ye men of the caravan, you have been guilty of theft.'" Right? This is the drinking cup episode in that story, part of the story. "And they said, turning towards them, 'What is it that you miss?' They replied, 'We miss the king's measuring cup. And whoso brings it shall have a camel load, and I am surety for it.' They answered, 'By Allah, you know well we came not to act corruptly in the land, and we are not thieves.' They said, 'What then shall be the punishment for it if you are found to have told a lie?' They replied, 'The punishment for it, he in whose saddlebag it is found shall himself be the penalty for it. Thus do we punish the wrongdoers.'" So, of course, the brothers are being accused of stealing the king's drinking cup. They said, "No, we didn't do that." And they said, "Well, if we find it on you, what should be the punishment?" And they said, "Well, guilty party is going to be the one in whose saddlebag the cup is found." Then he began the search with their sacks before the sack of his brother. So that was the last one. "Thus did we plan for Joseph. He could not have taken his brother under the king's law unless Allah had so willed. We raise in degrees of rank whomsoever we please, and over every possessor of knowledge is one most knowing." They said, if he has stolen, a brother of his had also committed theft before. But Joseph kept it secret in his heart and did not disclose it to them. He simply said, "You seem to be in the worst condition, and Allah knows best what you allege." They said, O exalted one, he has a very aged father. So take one of us in his stead. You know, basically, they found the cup, of course, with Joseph, with Benjamin, and if he is, they said, you know, earlier the previous verse, they said the brothers, I guess, said if he has stolen, a brother of his had also committed theft before. I must be referring to Joseph, although Joseph didn't do anything, but. I don't know, maybe they're saying it runs in the family. I'm not sure I understand exactly the point of that. But Joseph kept it secret in his heart. He did not disclose it to them, and he just said, you seem to be in the worst condition, blah, blah, blah. And they said, O exalted one, he, Benjamin, has a very aged father, so take one of us in his stead, for we see thee to be of those who do good. Joseph replied, Allah forbid that we should take any of him, any save him, with whom we found our property, for then we should surely be unjust. And when they despaired of him, they retreated, conferring together in private. Their leader said, I guess that's probably Reuben again, I don't know, I suppose so. Their leader said, Know ye not that your father has taken from you a solemn promise in the name of Allah, and how before this you failed in your duty with respect to Joseph? I will therefore not leave the land until my father permits me or Allah decides for me, and he is the best of judges. Return ye to your father and say, O our father, thy son has stolen, and we have stated only what we know, and we could not be guardians over the unseen. In other words, how are we supposed to know? You know, I mean, this happened. You know, you're right. We promised that we would not let any harm come to Benjamin. But guess what? But, you know, we're innocent. How are we supposed to see into the future? We don't have a crystal ball. And inquire of the people of the city wherein we were, and of the caravan with which we came, and certainly we are speaking the truth. You know, you can, in other words, they're going to tell Jacob, you can talk to anybody who was with us, you know, anybody in the caravan, or if you want to send somebody to the city, they'll vouch that we're not lying. He replied, this would be Jacob, nay, but your souls have embellished to you this thing, so now comely patience is good for me. May Allah will bring them all to me, for he is all-knowing, the wise. And he turned away from them and said, oh, my grief for Joseph. And also Benjamin, I guess, but I didn't mention Benjamin. And his eyes became white because of the grief, and he was suppressing his sorrow. They said, by Allah, thou wilt not cease talking of Joseph until thou art wasted away, or thou art of those who perish. He replied, I only complained of my sorrow and my grief to Allah, and I know from Allah that which you know not. O my sons, go ye and search for Joseph and his brother, and despair not of the mercy of Allah, for none despairs of Allah's mercy save the unbelieving people. And when they came before him, that now they're back in Egypt, I guess, Joseph, they said, O exalted one, poverty has smitten us and our family, and we've brought a paltry sum of money, so give us the full measure and be charitable to us. Surely Allah rewards the charitable. He said, do you know what you did to Joseph and his brother when you were ignorant? They replied, art thou Joseph? He said, yes, I am Joseph, and this is my brother. Allah has indeed been gracious to us. Verily, whoso is righteous and is steadfast, Allah will never suffer the reward of the good to be lost. They replied, by Allah, surely has Allah preferred thee above us, and we have indeed been the sinners. He said, no blame shall lie on you this day. May Allah forgive you, and he is the most merciful of those who show mercy. Go with this shirt of mine and lay it before my father. He will come to know and bring to me the whole of your family. So they're going to go back. Everything's happy. They're all happy now. This is Joseph, as it turned out. He had already told Benjamin that he was, you know, Joseph. But now the remaining 10 brothers also now are informed that this is Joseph and Benjamin's okay. You're forgiven. And here's my shirt. I don't know why, but maybe, you know, that somehow that's a token that they found, they've truly found Joseph, and bring your father back. And when the caravan departed, their father said, "Surely I feel the scent of Joseph, even though you take me to be a dotard." They replied, "By Allah, thou art surely in thy old error." And when the bearer of glad tidings came, he laid it before him, and he became enlightened. Then he said, "Did I not say to you, I know from Allah what you know not?" So I guess he was, was not the brothers there. I guess it was just other people. But then when they arrived and then told him the story, he said, "You see, I was right." They said, "Oh, our father, ask forgiveness of our sins for us, for we have indeed been sinners." He said, "I will certainly ask forgiveness for you of my Lord. Surely he is most forgiving, most merciful." And when they came to Joseph, he put up his parents with himself and said, "Enter Egypt in peace, if it please Allah." And he raised his parents upon the throne, and they all fell down prostrate before God for him. And he said, "O my father, this is the fulfillment of my dream of old. My Lord has made it true. And he bestowed a favor upon me when he took me out of the prison and brought you from the desert after Satan had stirred up discord between me and my brethren. Surely my Lord is benignant to those whomsoever he pleases, for he is the all-knowing, the wise. O my Lord, thou hast bestowed power upon me and taught me the interpretation of dreams. O maker of the heavens and the earth, thou art my protector in this world and the hereafter. Let death come to me in a state of submission to thy will, and join me to the righteous. That is of the tidings of the unseen which we reveal to thee." That was the end of the quote, by the way, of the righteous, an end quote. And this is, I guess, God speaking to Muhammad at this point. "That is the tidings of the unseen which we reveal to thee. And thou wast not with them when they agreed upon their plan while they were plotting, and most men will not believe it, even though thou eagerly desire it. And thou dost not ask of them any reward for it. On the contrary, it is but a source of honor for all mankind. And how many a sign is there in the heavens and the earth which they pass by, turning away from it? And most of them believe not in Allah without also attributing partners to him." In other words, the other gods, the polytheism. "Do they then feel secure from the coming on them of an overwhelming punishment from Allah, or the sudden coming of the hour upon them while they are unaware? Say, this is my way. I call unto Allah on sure knowledge, and I and those who follow me, and holy is Allah, and I am not of those who associate gods with God. And we send not before thee as messengers any but men whom we inspired from among the people of the towns. Have they not then traveled in the earth and seen what was the end of those before them? And surely the abode of the hereafter is better for those who fear God. Will you then understand? Till when the messengers despaired of the disbelievers, and they thought that they had been told a lie, our help came to them, and we saved him, whom we pleased, and our chastisement could not be averted from the sinful people. Assuredly, in their narrative is a lesson for men of understanding. It is not a thing that has been forged, but a fulfillment of that which is before it, and a detailed exposition of all things, and a guidance and a mercy to people who believe." End of Surah 12. So the story part of it actually ends with the end quote. You remember, I read all the way to verse 112, but the last of the story is Joseph's prayer, I guess. I mean, you know, in verse 101, that's where he says, "Oh, my father, thus is fulfilled." This is a very well-rounded story. You know, it starts off with the dream that he is exalted above all other people, and it, you know, kind of comes around full circle, and it ends with the reference to that dream where he says, "This is the fulfillment of my dream of old. You know, my Lord has made it true, and he's bestowed a favor on me," and so forth and so on. And then verse 102 is a prayer, and that really is the end of the story. He says, "O my Lord, thou hast bestowed power upon me and taught me the interpretation of dreams. O maker of heaven and earth, thou art my protector in this world and the hereafter. Let death come to me in a state of submission to thy will, and join me to the righteous. It's kind of a nice ending of the story, actually. But everything I read from there on, which is 103 through 112, the remaining 10 verses, is like commentary. It's commentary on the story, where God then is backing off and saying to Muhammad, this is yet another case of somebody who told, who delivered my message, my warnings to people, you know, take note and don't lose heart, because there have been disbelievers before and there have been some people who followed as well. Yeah, that's kind of the gist of that coda to the story, but it's more of a commentary on the story than the story itself. You know, actually the story ends at verse 102. So, any comments, questions, or anything like that?
I noticed that
that's a highly detailed story. Do you think there was a purpose in going into so much detail?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, as you know by now, the stories vary a lot in amount of detail. I mean, when we were talking about Noah, there's a lot. There was not an entire chapter devoted to Noah, but there was a chapter devoted to Hud earlier. So, of the various prophets, some seem to, you know, be... Well, they're more important maybe than others. I don't know, but you know, some are just mentioned in passing, like Jacob, for that matter. In fact, Jacob, I think, has more of a role in this story than he does in the in anywhere else. You know. Reuben, you're going to ask a question.
I was just noting that in this story, at the end, Joseph put his parents on the throne. It said,
"Well,"
but in the Bible, Rachel died giving birth to Benjamin.
Wait a minute now. Let me go back. Where was it? And he's raised? You're right. That's okay. Interesting. Yeah, he raised his parents upon the throne. Huh. Yeah. Okay. That's another kind of minor difference between this story and the other, and the Bible story.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Don, I also noticed it seemed like the sort of the big reveal... in this story, where Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, seemed kind of understated. I mean, it was sort of almost a throwaway line. Whereas in the Old Testament, it's much more of a big emotional event. You know, Joseph couldn't control himself, and he cried out, and his brothers were dismayed at his presence. When he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I don't know what that means, but it, I just was struck by it. It's like, that's just one little part of the story. Well, he reveals himself. Okay, well, let's go on.
Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, I was thinking the same thing as I was reading. You know, I remembered all these tears that flowed. I mean, when he first of all, remember, I think even earlier, when they first came. Now, I didn't go back and read the story like you are, but isn't it true that when they first showed up, he kind of goes off in a corner where nobody can see him, and he cries because of the emotion of seeing his family, right? Isn't that right?
And he's very dramatic with them about, you know, the outrage of all the how they stole from him and things like that. It's much more emotional content.
Well, I guess bottom line is maybe. I mean, we're talking about a literary difference here, and maybe the biblical account is just more skillfully written in that sense. I mean, it has more, it tugs at you maybe more than this does. Although I think one thing here, I mean, you know, of course, this is not supposed to be great, I mean, literature from that standpoint, but this particular story, I think the prayer at the end in verse 102, well, actually 101 and 102, where 101 kind of goes back and reminds us of the very first event that happened right at the very beginning of the surah, and then 102 is this prayer to Allah. I think that's a kind of a nice, you know, technique, you know, to conclude the story in this particular case. But you're right, from a literary standpoint, the other is much more emotional, engages the reader probably a lot more, since the feelings are made more more apparent. Yeah, good point. Anything else?
With these differences, there are quite a few in this one and quite a few in the Noah.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to take any idea of a theological difference in the incidents that are mentioned in the Old Testament, but not what was ends up in the Quran?
Well, I'm not sure. Nothing occurs to me off the top of my head, a theological difference. What strikes me, now somebody correct me if you think otherwise, but these seem to me to be differences of minor detail. You know, for example, does Rachel die or not? Or was it a wolf or a lion who supposedly killed Joseph? Or, Potiphar's wife confesses and he's in prison for a slightly different reason. I don't know. What do you think? Those seem to me to be just, you know, the kind of things that if a story is floating around, you know how it is. A story is floating around and you go over here and there's this little version of it and you go over here and a few things have changed and that sort of thing, but nothing.
Well, if you look at our Bible, you know, your Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, the same story told in different ways.
True.
Then you have the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they often tell the same story a little differently.
Yes, yes. And that seems to be the more or less equivalent to what's going on here, I think. I can't, you know, offhand, nothing very deep occurs to me in terms of the, you know, the differences between the Bible account and the Quran account. I think the historical lesson to be drawn is that, you know, as I keep on saying, there's all these variations of stories floating around. When you look at the Nag Hammadi Library, I pointed that out a few weeks ago, you know, when you look at that, you see a lot of familiar biblical stories, but there's always a little tweak in there, and they have a little different coloring than the ones in the Bible. In that case, though, there is a more significant theological difference because those are Gnostic texts. I don't know. Anybody else? Does anybody see any particular significance in this?
Well, Don, if you were to summarize the theological message, it wouldn't be that long and in-depth anyway of the story.
Right. I mean, Allah is... There are no gods besides Allah. That's one of the, one of the lessons. And Allah is merciful. And all-knowing, practically every verse has that's a little much, but it's almost like every 10 verses or something you have some commentary about Allah. That's the sum and substance of it. Okay, well, let's move on to our next prophet. Let's see, now Joseph is, he's number 11. So the next one is Job. Let me get him up on the board. This is Ayub, and that's Job. And we have, two passages here. And I think, yeah, they're marked in blue, so I can find those easily. Okay. The first one is 21, 84, and 85, just two verses here, Surah 21. And remember Job, when he cried to his Lord, saying, affliction has touched me, and thou art the most merciful of all who show mercy. So we heard his prayer and removed the distress from which he suffered, and we gave him his family and the like thereof with them as a mercy from us and as a reminder for the worshippers. The next one is 38:42-45. And remember our servant Job, when he cried unto his Lord, saying, Satan has afflicted me with toil and torment. Strike and urge thy riding beast with thy foot. This is God. Wait a minute. Okay, man. Let me do this again. So, and remember our servant Job, when he cried unto his Lord, saying, quote, Satan has afflicted me with toil and torment, end quote. Quote again. This would be God speaking, I guess. Strike and urge thy riding beast with thy foot. Here is cool water to wash and a drink with and a drink. And in the footnote, there's a footnote here. Another, this makes much more sense. Another translation of strike and urge thy riding beast with thy foot is just spur on your mount. That makes a lot more sense. Spur on your mount. Here is cool water to wash with and a drink. And we bestowed on him, there's another footnote too, and we bestowed on him his family and as many more with them by way of mercy from us and as a reminder to men of understanding. And the footnote has, and we bestowed on him and his family and many, I'm sorry, we bestowed on him his family and many like them along with them by way of mercy from us as a reminder to men of understanding. That's it for Job. Now there's a couple of other verses where he's mentioned in passing, but I don't bother to read those because those are just lists of prophets. So, well, this one is, I think, very ripe for biblical contrasts, right? I mean, my goodness. You know, in my Ali class, one of them, I guess it was my Islamic and Jewish class, I think it was yesterday. What's today? Sunday. Friday, 2 days ago. Job came up. Somebody mentioned the story of Job because we were talking about the problem of evil. Somebody mentioned the story of Job. And, of course, the main thrust of that is, of course, Job's sufferings, right? I mean, my goodness. I mean, I don't know how many chapters Job is, but you know, like 95 or 98% of the story of Job is Job's sufferings and then his three friends, Elihu and what's the other two guys' names? Bildad and Eliphaz, I think. I can't remember. But anyway, their responses, you know, to Job, basically something to the effect of, you know, you must have really done something horrible to be punished like this. And Job keeps on saying, no, I didn't, you know, I did not do anything. And one of them, remember, says, curse God and die and all of that. And they really get nowhere in their discussion. And it kind of at the end, as somebody pointed out in my Ali class, you know, at the end, he just says, well, you know, God does what God does. And that's the way it is. And we can't understand why God does what God does. And then somebody else pointed out, but at the end of the story, God gives everything back, you know, and more. You know, this was a, remember, the story started out with a conversation between God and Satan, right? And there's this bet going on. And Satan says, I bet you I can get Job to curse you. And God says, I bet you you can't. And then so Satan, you know, sets up all these horrible torments that Job undergoes. And God turns out to be right. He does not curse God. And then at the end of the story, as the person in class pointed out, that God restores everything to Job, plus even more than he had before. And then somebody else pointed out correctly that scholars think that little coda at the end of the story of Job was a later addition because somebody didn't get it. You know, somebody didn't like the fact there wasn't a happy ending. So this whoever this was, you know, added a little bit to the end to make sure that the story turned out happily. And the point that was made, I think, by one of the earlier ones, people, was that sort of ruins the whole point of the story. At least one way of interpreting it, I'll leave this open to you all, but one way of interpreting it is that God's ways are inscrutable. And we're always bothered by why God would allow the things that obviously are allowed. I always use the example, it's just this really heartrending website about Aaron Zev Kushner, the son of Rabbi Kushner, who wrote that book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And, you know, he had a genetic, as you know, a genetic disease that caused him to age prematurely. And so when he was 13, it's as though he were 80 or something like that. And he finally died right after his 14th birthday, I think. And he weighed only 25 pounds, it said, in that website. And gee whiz, I mean, he never had a chance, at a normal life at all. And I also remembered, and I mentioned in the class the other day, the bubble boy. Remember the bubble boy who had no immune system, I think it was, and spent his whole life in the bubble. And then he finally, I never quite got the details on that one. He finally came, they finally took him out of the bubble. I don't know if it was just that they just gave up. And then he immediately got a cold or something and died because he had, you know, had no immune system. And he didn't have a chance either, you know. And then, of course, that's what the story of Job is addressing, right? And you know, Job didn't deserve what happened to him. But, and then the end, well, not the end, the almost end, is kind of saying, you know, God's ways are inscrutable. God's, you know, where were you when I created the heavens and the earth? You know, you weren't around. I suppose you know all this stuff, you know, says God sarcastically. And, you know, of course, the idea is that our knowledge is so infinitesimal compared to God's, you know, that there's no way we can ever answer that question. And then this idiot, you know, adds the, is not satisfied with that and adds a good ending to it. So everything, you know, everybody, they all lived happily ever after. And that just sort of, from at least a lot of people's perspective, that just ruins the whole story. You know, the whole point was the major point. But that's what the Quran picks up on. It, you know, there's, of course, it's very abbreviated, nothing like the Joseph story by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, Job's sufferings are referred to. And in the next breath, and God, you know, fixed everything and he, you know, lived happily ever after. Now, why?
Hey, Don?
Yeah.
You know, it would seem, you know, I had commented about the detail of the Joseph story. That story kind of wanders around a lot. And the Job story in the Bible is pretty punchy, you know, mm-hmm. arguing with the friends. You know, there's not a lot of wasted stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty powerful story that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
You would think that here they could, the Quran would cover more of that because it's a pretty effective story.
Well, I think, correct me if you disagree, but I think, you know, remember the main message of Muhammad is that God is perfectly just. Therefore, God will punish the unbelievers unmercifully, and God will more than reward the believers. It's a really a, you know, tit for tat, black and white kind of situation. You know, you're either over here or you're over here. You get one chance, and what happens is extreme on both sides. I mean, you know, I haven't read the many verses, but I will in the future at some point when we start talking about themes other than the prophets, but the many verses where it, you know, it says that the people who are saved, they will go to these gardens and overflowing with food and drink and all this one beyond your wildest imagination. I mean, that's just really extreme. And of course, you know, the other extreme too. I mean, you know, you're just going to burn forever physically in hell.
God, does that mean you're thinking that the Quran is downplaying the fact that God let this misery happen to an undeserving Job?
Yeah, actually, that's right. Yeah, but I mean, the emphasis on is, here you got this good person who was afflicted, and God, you know, but in the next breath, that person obviously, of course, is getting rewarded, because God is perfectly just, rewards the righteous and punishes the unrighteous. And this whole dialectic in the book of Job and this agonizing over the problem of evil and the business about how can we ever possibly grasp God's infinite plans, I don't see a word of it. Not a word of it. So it's like the story of Job then is used to reinforce this main theme of the Quran about, you know, God rewarding the just and punishing the unjust, that kind of thing. But what strikes us as the main deal in the book of Job is entirely omitted. I mean, you do, the only thing you have is, well, he suffered. Yeah, okay, well, we all know that. But all the theological points, I guess you would say, that are made in that dialectic between Job and his friends and whatnot, not a word of it here, nor is there any whiff of, you know, the final resolution before the coda, you know, that, you know, we can't understand God's ways. You know, I think that's really interesting. I mean, you know, what's interesting is, at least when we contrast this story with all the other stories of which there's any detail, is the Quran amazingly tracks the Bible pretty well, don't you think? I mean, usually there's a lot of overlap between the Bible story and the Quran story. Every one we've seen so far where there's any detail at all, you've got a lot of overlap. You know, there's different. This goes back to Marty's question earlier. Yeah, there are little differences of detail and stuff like that. You know, was it a wolf or was it a lion? And did the Potiphar's wife confess or not? You know, and back in the Noah story, there were little, you know, minor things. But from a macro perspective, you know, pretty consistent. But here, I think there's an enormous discrepancy between the Bible and the Quran. What do you think?
If it's about justice, and that's what the Quran was trying to point out with Job, mm-hmm. isn't it? Don't you run into a problem with the fact that in the Quran, Job had to tell Allah that he was suffering?
Huh.
Why was he suffering in the first place, well, if that justice thing is going on?
Yeah, well, let's see now. And remember Job when he cried to his Lord. Boy, you're really good at this, picking up all the details. I'm just sitting here reading, you know. Well, let's see, did he say that or not? Yeah. Affliction has touched me as though, well, surely Allah knew that, though. And thou art most merciful. All he's doing is crying for mercy. And the second one, cried unto the Lord, saying, Satan has afflicted me with toil and torment. I don't think there's an implication here that Allah didn't know what was going on. But I think you need to read that as a plea for mercy. But, you know, you're right. I mean, why was he suffering in the first place? And I guess the answer to that is, well, people suffer. We do know that. Now, there's no attempt to explain that here. That's the whole point, isn't it? That's my whole point.
Well, I was wondering if the... Islam puts a lot of emphasis on practices, certain practices,
right.
And praying five times a day is one of them.
Right.
And it seems to me that you got a Job prayed here, mm-hmm. and this is part of the might be an emphasis on that particular practice.
That is possibly a subsidiary theme. I can see that. Yeah. Well, just in general, submission to Allah, of course, that's what Islam means. It means submission. And I read that word earlier today. I don't remember if it was in this story or not, probably the other one. But, yeah.
I think they're both very similar in the fact that they show that he gets back everything that he had before and more so. And the Bible wanted that, the Old Testament wanted that idea too, that if you stick with God,
mm-hmm.
you'll be rewarded.
Yes.
And with much less interesting detail, mm-hmm. the Quran says the same thing.
Well, I mean, of course, that's the Deuteronomist perspective, right? I mean, that's the whole deal there. But, yeah, looking at it just that way, yes. But the point is, like 98% of Job is this wrenching discussion of, you know, why God would allow evil to occur. And the fact that that's entirely missing from the Quran account just impoverishes the latter compared to the former, seems to me. I mean, I don't think you can just gloss over that and say, well, that's of no account. That's the main point of Job. And that little coda at the end, which scholars think that somebody added on there just because the person wanted a good ending and sort of missed the point of the main story. If that's a correct assessment, then that just heightens the difference between the Quran and the Bible, it seems to me.
And the fact that the Quran leaves out the idea of God is almost toying with Job by allowing...
That too.
And what's the word? They don't use the word Satan in the Old Testament.
The adversary, I think, or
yeah.
The... Yeah.
So that gives him... It just sounds like they're two lawyers arguing.
Yes, yes, yes. That's the way it's presented.
And it almost... Or two guys making a bet. It puts God in a very... in a less than flattering light, I've always thought.
Yeah.
And the Quran leaves that out, or at least doesn't emphasize it. Granted, God is... allowing, or at least this is what happens, bad stuff happens.
Yeah.
But God is not seen as almost causing it or allowing it and maybe even chuckling over it.
Right. That's true. The only thing is just, you know, you might say that 98% of it is glossed over and just the very most general point is made. He was suffering. Okay, fine. And then the great emphasis on that little coda at the end. You're right. And maybe that depiction of God, you know, maybe since it's not maybe so flattering, maybe. Maybe that's one motive for leaving it out. I don't know. Yeah.
One of my religious instructors, Dr. Bryan, told me that a lot of the scholars believe that Job was written as a play. Hmm. It's all fictitious, but it was written as a play.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Because an awful lot is dialogue. And I could see different people, of course, you know, taking those parts. Yeah. Good point. Anything else?
Did Marty say that the story of Job doesn't refer to Satan?
No, she said that they refer to Satan obliquely, right, as the adversary, isn't that right? I mean, I'm going by memory. It's like two lawyers. I mean, it really is a sort of a legal sort of setup the beginning.
In the New Revised Standard Version, it specifically refers to Satan. It says the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came, and the Lord said to Satan, etc. And then I just went to get the King James, and it also refers to Satan.
Oh, well, then maybe my memory could be faulty. It's not the first time. Let's see, Job. Let's see.
The King James, the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came before them.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why I've always... I mean, I don't know my Old Testament super well, but that has always stuck in my mind. So it must have been some translation that I read that I was surprised it did not use the term Satan. It used, as you say, some, you know, sounding like a legal term or someone on a almost equal to God.
Stupid me.
and where I got that idea.
Well, to be fair, Marty, this is Tom. I'm just looking up something on the web, and another reference says that the book of Job calls Satan an adversary or prosecutor as an agent of God.
Right. That's what I was remembering. Now, here we go. Now, I'm just looking at it. Now, this is the RSV, my old RSV that's falling apart. I couldn't even remember where it is. Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs. Yeah, I had all the books of the Bible memorized at one point. Now there was a day, this is verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, blah, where did Satan answer? But anyway, there's a footnote with after Satan, and it says, in Hebrew, it's the adversary, which is exactly what I said. So, I mean, to translate it, Satan then is a gloss, I guess, on the Hebrew.
Well, like, my note says that in Hebrew, the way it would be pronounced, the adversary or the accuser would be pronounced ha-satan. And so it's just taking part of that word and making it the name.
Yes, yes. And once again, that could be a Zoroastrian gloss, right? I mean, that's really where the idea of Satan per se comes from. You know, the Zoroastrians had this dualistic religion. And when the, you know, when the Hebrews or the Jews, you could say, were deported by Nebuchadnezzar into the, you know, they would have, and then Cyrus the Great, you know, was instituted Zoroastrianism in the Persian Empire. That's when these ideas filtered into Judaism, including the idea of Satan and some other things too. And then they could just take that word, which really just means something else, and turn it into a name, which is kind of what you're suggesting. Anything else?
So, Don, I'm sorry, I sort of lost the thread. In the Quran, there's not this this Satan or this accuser. It just sort of There's no setup.
Right. There's no setup. That's just not there at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Much to the impoverishment, it seems to me, of the Quran version of it. Okay, well, we got to quit. We're on the cusp of Shu'aib. Shu'aib, I know you want to hear all about Shu'aib next week, and you know who Shu'aib is. That is Jethro. Isn't that interesting? So, I mean, brush up on your Jethro, which is very easy because there's not too much in the Bible about Jethro, but there's quite a bit in the Quran about Shu'aib. So we will hear all about that next week. So see ya in a week.
Thanks. Thanks, Don.
Sure.
Thanks, Don.
I can't. There we go.